Martha McPhee and her four sisters each have a new book published this season. McPhee is the daughter of the writer John McPhee. But when she was very young, her parents divorced. Her first novel, Bright Angel Time, was the semi-autobiographical story of a girl whose divorced mother marries a former Jesuit seminarian turned Gestalt therapist and father of five named Anton. Anton has become a New Age guru, famous for his experiments in communal living. The young girl has to make the transition from a structured middle-class life to life in a new blended family of hippies. Martha McPhee's new novel is a follow-up in which the now adult children have traveled to Anton's bedside to be with him as he dies of cancer. The new novel is called Gorgeous Lies. Now, your character in Bright Angel Time, the 8-year-old narrator, writes, "This is how we blended. We had to give each other everything and not look back and not get upset. Give, give, give until our identities melted together. No privacy, no locked doors, not even while peeing. There should be nothing to hide if we loved each other. If one of us wanted to be alone, it meant something was wrong, that that person wasn't having fun." Was there pressure like that in your family to be like so open that everything was shared? You couldn't have anything for yourself. All doors had to be open. There was no privacy. That was considered selfish or individualistic?
It wasn't exactly like that. But I mean, because certainly you could shut the doors if you were peeing. But I really think that my mother and my stepfather wanted to make this family work at all costs. They wanted us to love each other like sisters and brothers. And for the most part, I'd say they succeeded. They wanted us to feel that my oldest stepbrother, Danny, was, you know, as good as a brother to me as he was to his younger siblings. And, you know, I see a lot of step-siblings that hardly know each other. It's not our case. And I cherish that. I cherish that I have these people in my life and that I, you know, they're not exactly siblings, but they're almost siblings. And it's a special relationship.
Your new novel centers around the death of the stepfather. He's on his deathbed during much of the novel, and the children are coming to visit, and they're rethinking their relationship with him. So much of the book centers around the stepfather. How do you think your stepfather, who has also passed away, would have felt knowing that he is the most autobiographical presence in this book, that in writing this novel, you fictionalized a lot, but a lot of your stepfather's essence is also the essence of the stepfather in the book?
Well, you know, when I began this novel, I had no idea that it was about him. In fact, I thought it was about a girl who was going to India. And slowly, he crept into the book and took it over. And there's a saying that, you know, the characters take over the novel and when it's really going well. And I've always resisted that because I think that that the writer should have more control. I don't like to give in to that. But it really did happen. And it is a truth that, you know, you sometimes can't really direct where your subconscious takes you. And he was in me like a seed, and he began to blossom. He drove into my life in a turquoise Cadillac when I was 4 years old, and he was an amazing, strong figure, a Texan playing poker, winning lots of money, and he'd come to our house and he'd throw it up into the air and it would flutter to the ground, and he was magical. He had big stories, and he was also a former Jesuit and a Gestalt therapist, and these words were tremendously big to me, and they were exciting because I didn't know what they meant, and I wanted to understand them. And my whole life, I've wanted to understand who this person was. And I took it on in fiction.
You mentioned that your first novel, Bright Angel Time, was told from the point of view of an 8-year-old girl because you'd read a lot about, you know, the hippie years and LSD and all that from the point of view of adults, but you were wondering what a child growing up with all of that would think. From your point of view, what are some of the things that a child would have thought or might have thought that would go really counter to what the adults would have wanted them to think?
Well, I think that I would never have said this, but the book was reviewed in the New York Times Book Review by Walter Kern, and he said, It seems that McPhee, and I'm not quoting it directly because I don't have it in front of me, but it says, it seems that McPhee is saying that children are basically conservative. I would never have, I didn't understand that consciously, but when he put it that way, I thought, oh, wow, they are. They like routine. I have a little daughter now. She loves routine. And we like, as children, to know when dinner is going to be on the table. I remember at my father's house, my stepmother was very traditional in that sense. You ate every night at 6 p.m. You ate meat, a vegetable, and a starch. And I loved going there because there was always plenty, and it was always, you know, it's always at 6. It would never have occurred to me that was the case, because children love to play and they love to be free. But I guess that was, in some ways, what I was saying.
Your stepfather sounds like the kind of person who would likely have some sense of what a good life was and what a good death was, and that he would have wanted a certain type of death, or at least wanted to behave in a certain way when staring death in the face. You know, kind of like embracing the continuity of life and death and so on. I'm wondering, you know, and this is, a lot of the new novel takes place on his deathbed. I'm wondering if your father did have that kind of sense of the type of death he wanted, and what he was really like when he died. What?
Well, there's this expression, we die as we live.
Mm-hmm.
And his life was, you know, he was impulsive. He loved life, and he loved every aspect of it, whether it was the good or the bad. And it led him to, you know, to go too far. Let's put it that way. But and also, as a result, it could often create a lot of chaos. I think his death was exactly the same way. He was surrounded by every single one of his children. We were there coming from California, from India, from near and far to be with him. And we were from diagnosis in June to his death in late November, there were always 4 or 5 of us there with him. And I think that is how he would have enjoyed it. I think he was scared, and I think he wished he, you know, when he was healthy, I think he would have wished that he would not have been scared in the face of death, but he was. And there was all the, you know, all the chaos of life surrounding the dying.
We've talked a lot about your stepfather. Your father is the writer John McPhee, who's famous for the detailed essays he's written in The New Yorker magazine on subjects as diverse as geology, how oranges are grown in the era of high-tech cultivation, and a portrait of Bill Bradley written when Bradley was still playing basketball. And in his writing, everything was really perfectly ordered, precisely described, factually precise. But also, the essays were never about him. If he used the word I to describe himself in an essay, that was considered really radical. John McPhee used first person. He used the word I in an essay.
Wait till you read his new book.
Really?
It's fabulous, all about shad, and he loves to shad fish, so the I is very prevalent.
Uh-huh. Well, what's his opinion of you writing this kind of autobiographical fiction in which a lot of readers are going to confuse what's fiction with what's real? And he, you know, he has a surrogate figure in the stories.
My father wants me to write well. That's what he cares about. He hopes that I have expressed myself the best way that I can. And he too, he's a writer. He's an artist. He knows what goes into the making of things, and he knows that it's different for everybody. He couldn't write autobiographically if he wanted to. And
do you think that's true, that there's just, that he's just not like, this is what you're wired to do, and it's exactly what he's not wired to do?
I think so. I mean, if I could have chosen to write about the story that I wanted to, that I set out to write with the girl going off to India, I would have loved to have done that, but I was pulled in a different direction. And that's how it happens. And he knows that. He's been pulled in a very different direction. And I am very close with my father, and I call him up regularly to talk about everything from an image. I needed an image at the end of the first novel for two periods of rock of vastly different ages that come together. And I said, oh, help me, I need an image. And he said, think of a set of encyclopedias from A to Z with everything from F to T missing. And I used it. It was fabulous. And I think he wants to see me thrive. He wants to see me to succeed. When I was a little kid, he always said, don't write. He said it to all of us. Don't write. Stay away from writing. A writer doesn't choose to write. A writer has to write. And then he'd say, you know, the average annual income of a writer is $800 a year. Stay away from it. But he couldn't keep us away.
And so he doesn't feel like he is subtly being drawn into this emotional drama through your fiction, you know, a public emotional drama.
Well, I think if he thought that I was sitting down to write in order to make $1 million revealing family secrets and hanging out dirty laundry, maybe he would. But he knows that's not what I'm after. That's not what compels me to write. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested, you know, in exploring the puzzle. And he sees the intent in my work. And, you know, whether I succeed or not is a different question, but I am trying to create a piece of art. That is my aspiration, not telling my family story.
Well, Martha McPhee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. Thanks very much.
Martha McPhee's new novel is called Gorgeous Lies. This is Fresh Air.